Are tuned to CFRO, Vancouver's Cooperative Radio, 102.7 FM. And it's time for Animal Voices. And we have something of a menagerie out in the hallway today. There's animals milling around. And there's an elephant. An elephant coming into the studio. It's moving up to one of the mics.
Welcome to Animal Voices on Co-op Radio in Vancouver, 102.7 FM. My name is John Pranger, and with me in the studio are Marge Adams, Jenna Hunt, Carl Loskin, and our guest, Anthony Marr. I'll just introduce our show briefly. Anthony Marr started in late 1999, an environmental, I think it was 1999 or 2000, environmental spiritual organization called Hope Geo. And he now devotes himself to lobbying many of the world's nations to redirect a portion of their defense budgets to environmental conservation, and he teaches a New Age philosophy he calls omniscient cosmology. His undercover work during the 1995 and 1996 assembled a body of evidence that helped motivate Canadian lawmakers to ban the sale of all products derived from tigers. And today, the sale of products containing tiger derivatives is punishable with large fines and substantial jail terms. At 12:30, we'll be talking to Dr. Alka Chandra of PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, about the sickening so-called science that goes on at Covance Laboratories, where a PETA undercover investigation documented and photographed the brutal treatment of monkeys used to test drugs. Last month, PETA released the findings of its 11-month investigation into Covance's Virginia laboratory. Undercover footage reveals repeated violations of the Animal Welfare Act by Covance workers, including hitting monkeys in the face and choking them and taunting them, and failing to administer veterinary care to very severely wounded monkeys, and failing to provide euthanasia to monkeys in extreme distress, and so on and so on. So we're going to be talking to Anthony Marr in a few minutes, but first, a letter from Carl to the NDP.
Oh, yes. Oh, you take me by surprise here.
Oh, did
yes,
I? I thought I...
But anyway, what's happening is they are having a feast, a lobster feast. Yes, and you know, each person who donates $100 will be on this feast will have two lobsters on their plate. And, well, you know, even though there is a vegetarian option, we felt that this, people need to know need to know a little bit about the animal cruelty involved with lobsters. And this is the letter I wrote to the politicians. I said, politics is often cruel, but does it have to extend to the animal kingdom? We have always felt a great discomfort while observing lobsters held captive in holding tanks with their claws bound closed. From the moment the lobster walks into a trap until it lands in the pot, it is filled with, inverted commas, pain galore. Trapped lobsters experience major changes in their environment before they are boiled. They endure extreme temperature and pressure changes as they are yanked from the ocean floor to the surface. They are shipped with thousands of other creatures and held in tanks along with particles of their own waste.
It may take weeks before these lobsters are consumed for dinner, and many retailers don't feed them to minimize excretion. All that translates into extremely stressed out lobsters. So that is what happens when we see these lobsters, and what one needs to know where your food comes from and how it's grown. And that's part of Animal Voices.
And I'm sorry to hear that the NDP is so insensitive to such an issue. It often claims to be, I don't know. Are we having trouble with our mics?
No?
Everything's fine. Good. Well, I hope you heard the first of Carl's remarks, too, and because they seemed a little fuzzy here. But I thought that the NDP sort of more or less prided itself on its stance on environmental concerns and so on. It's more or less the people's choice, you know. But here we see them quite blind to suffering.
Yes, it is up to us. It is up to the people to make people aware of it. And they are sensitive to the issues. And the more people speak out, the more they will react to what the people want.
And when did you receive this invitation? And when?
Well, it's happening on the 17th.
On the 17th.
It's coming Friday or Saturday.
So do you think you'll be able to get them to change their minds and the menu or what?
No, I don't think I'll be able to change them, but I think at least we raise the issue, and the next time it will be they might consider this.
Thank you.
So you know, my friend Diana, she had a wonderful saying. She said, you know, it takes about 7 times till somebody gets a message about something that they're interested in until they react on it. And, you know, just keep on going, because you never know when it's the 7th time.
Do you have another little editorial you want to share with us? Or?
Oh, sure.
Yeah?
You know, well, of course, Paul Watson was in town last week, and many people really enjoyed his program. And when he spoke in Vancouver, and he comes over with such a bountiful message, and so does Anthony Marr, of course, and he's a matured speaker. And I wrote to the Paul Watson who was speaking in Edmonton, and they wrote a wonderful editorial about what Paul Watson had been doing, and I wrote to the Edmonton newspaper thanking them for having written such a nice editorial about Paul Watson, and he's often confronted with more than things that are not very kind. So I wrote to the editor, and I said, Captain Paul Watson dares to put compassion ahead of economic interests. The time has come for animals to be considered as sentient beings instead of unregulated industrial commodities. The cruel slaughtering of seals for their skins and specified body parts, I didn't want to mention that, it was the penises they were after, is a disgrace to the national image. The question is not, can they reason, nor can they talk, but rather, can they suffer? And as such, humans have an obligation to have due regard for their kindred species, the animals.
Thanks very much, Carl. You're listening to Animal Voices, 102.7 FM in Vancouver. And now, an interview with Anthony Marr and Marge Adams.
Thank you, John. Anthony Marr is a tireless worker for animals. He has campaigned for years on behalf of numerous species, including the tiger, lion, bear, seal, and dolphin. Anthony is an accomplished public speaker and author of a thought-provoking book about the meaning of life entitled Omniscience. He is the founder of the organization HOPE, which stands for Heal Our Planet Earth. Anthony Marr has recently returned to his home in Vancouver from a 3-month journey through 15 western states and 4 western provinces. This was an educational tour concentrating on the Canadian seal hunt and the slaughter of dolphins in Japan, events which Anthony has campaigned against for years. Welcome once again to Animal Voices, Anthony.
Thank you once again, Marge.
It's wonderful to have you back in the studio. Anthony, perhaps we could start with an overview of the tour that you've just completed. Something about where you traveled and how you did that.
It was a bit of a clockwise circle with a little dent in it in the middle. Started with the 4 Canadian provinces to Manitoba, and then down to Minnesota, Wisconsin, so on, down to Louisiana. I was also in New Orleans. That's as far southeast as I went, and that city was beautiful back then.
Yes, how it's
changed.
I
hope that it will be again. And then I headed back west, but made an inland incursion into Colorado and Utah, and then back to Texas and Arizona, and then up the coast, California, Oregon, and Washington. So it added up to about 4 Canadian provinces and 15 Western United States. And the purpose of that tour was kind of multifaceted. The main one certainly would be a campaign to organize a campaign with the U.S. grassroots groups. And I stress the word grassroots because there are major, huge organizations like the Humane Society of the U.S., that is doing a very major campaign. But the grassroots, if they are organized into a coalition and work on that campaign as strongly as everyone could, then it would be as momentous as a huge organization. So that's against the Canadian seal hunt. And then I also wanted to spread the news of the Japanese dolphins. I made a pledge to them that I would just thinking about them gives me a catch in my throat right now.
Oh,
it's a horrible thing, but I have made a pledge to a dolphin that I would spread the news to the North American public so that we could help them out. And I was fulfilling that obligation
and
to the dolphins.
You were driving all this distance, I guess. You weren't going by...
Yeah, it was about 20,000 kilometers.
Wow. That's a lot of traveling. And you had contacts wherever you stopped, did you?
Yes, I did, actually. I was treated like a prince everywhere I went, and I was always taken into somebody's home in every city I went to. So I never did have to stay in one single motel all this way. It's just gas money and food, basically.
Yeah, so you were quite focused on your subjects then, weren't you? Just the dolphin slaughter in Japan and the seal hunt in Canada?
Well, of course, the tiger is always... in the back of my mind somewhere. Well, not just the back of my mind, always, you know, once in a while pops to the forefront. I always have my tiger conservation slideshow with me anyway, and whenever people request it, I would give it. So it would be a three-prong, actually. It would be tiger, dolphins, and seals.
Yes, it's very difficult, isn't it, to have a broad spectrum of topics.
Yes and no. If it's broad spectrum, then people get to choose between A, B, and C instead of yes and no. Mm-hmm. And my car was sort of decorated the whole way. I had painted on my car, I am Canadian, boycott my country. And that is in regards to the Canadian seal hunt issue, of course. It is an international effort to put pressure on Canada to stop the seal hunts by means of boycotting the seafood industry, which is a huge industry given the U.S. is its major customer to the tune of about $3.5 billion a year. So we hope to be able to knock off about 10 or 20 or 30% of that. And if that can be done, let's say if it's 20% or 30%, then it would be about, I would say, easily $60 or $100 million knocked off the Canadian revenue, and the seal hunt only brings in about $15 million. So anything over and above $15 million would be very effective.
How did you go about convincing people of this? What were the techniques you used, Anthony?
Well, basically, what I do is to hold meetings and presentations with the local groups everywhere I went, and they would organize talks for me advertise to the general public and in public libraries and so on. And basically, I would just give a presentation, and after that, a discussion, and then after that, a meeting with the key people, the leaders of these local groups and grassroots groups, as well as anybody who was gung-ho enough in the audience to want to stay behind and, you know, have a discussion, strategic discussion. Then we will talk about strategy, tactics, as well as organize a piece of action. And we have had several very high-profile pieces of actions along the way. For example, there was one that involved about 12 or 13 cars, and we got all these cars, not just mine, decorated with posters and everything like that all over the cars. And we drove from Houston to Dallas, which is 350 kilometers, which is would represent a length of a line of dead seals, single file, to the tune of 350,000 seals, 1 meter each. And the media loved it, and they just covered them all. I also did a one, for example, from San Diego to Los Angeles, because in Los Angeles there was the AR 2005 Animal Rights 2005 conference, and lots of activists participated coming from San Diego. So I talked to this group of activists, and we said, you know, we're going to be driving to Los Angeles anyway. Why don't we do this as a funeral motorcade for the seals? And so everybody thought that was a great idea, and then once again, we got media coverage. So that's just two examples of a string of pretty good events.
Do you think that's the best way to educate people, is getting media coverage?
Well, that's why I'm here, Marge.
Well, thank you for that.
But I think keywords in activism is media, media, media. There's no doubt about that.
Uh-huh. Now, and I'm interested in the fact you were getting grassroots people involved and getting the leadership of those various organizations. Now, what kind of action, apart from these motorcades and so on, were proposed in these meetings?
Well, in every city, we usually do a demo in front of a Red Lobster restaurant, a local Red Lobster restaurant, except we have a new strategy now. We are not asking Red Lobster to join us in this Boycott Canada campaign, because they're not doing that. So we have crossed over into boycotting Red Lobster if you do not join this boycott. Because the reason to me is quite obvious. You know, we cannot use compassionate reasons to change the Canadian government to ban the seal hunt for the reason that they only care for the almighty buck. So does Red Lobster. You cannot use compassion to move a corporation which boils alive thousands of lobsters every day for people's consumption and pleasure. So they are talking about money too. So you know, why do we have to boycott Canada? Because compassion won't work with them. So we're going to use the same tactic with Red Lobsters. And there's a string of local groups which are pursuing that objective.
I see. So this is international pressure that you're using by getting people in the U.S., the biggest market, to boycott.
International pressure is usually the most powerful lever.
Is it?
According to my experience, as well as reading.
Now, the seal hunt doesn't start until mid-March. So that why did you choose this time of year to go on this circular about the seal hunt?
Well, I think you put the finger on the pulse of why the movement has been so weak up to this point, because everybody just do one demo mid-March every year, and it's like a flash in a pan. And then for the other 364 days a year, there's nothing. So this time we're going to keep the pressure on year-round and continuously, non-seasonally, just year-round, until the objective is achieved.
And that you will have contact with these groups where you have established your name and your presence already, so you will be in contact and working together?
Yeah, this is what I'm dealing with right now. I've been back to Vancouver from the tour for about a month, so I'm just beginning to crank up a new momentum, which is to systematically organize this movement.
And have you had any encouraging feedback from, I'm certainly from individuals and these active groups, but anything beyond that you could tell us about?
Well, the local groups, I sort of keep in touch with me, and they sort of keep in touch with me, and I keep in touch with them, and they inform me of their progress. And so their progress now is along a new direction, the one that I suggest, which is sort of more direct and strong-armed approach with Red Lobster. And I think that sooner or later they're going to succumb. And I also want, of course, I've only done half of this tour. The eastern half still need to be done, and there are much, you know, far more groups in the east than in the west. So once the entire North America has been mobilized this way, I believe that Red Lobster will succumb.
And will you be doing that maybe in the spring, or have you set yourself a goal yet?
Well, right now I've got a big problem, which is that I'm a little bit stuck, because I have My problem is that I don't not that I don't have any plans. Is that I've got too many alternative plans, so I've got to choose one definitely before I can move on. So that is certainly very much on the agenda, and that would probably be in next early next spring. No, late next winter, like January, February, and March. October, November, December, I will go back down to the U.S. To California, because a few groups invited me to go back to do some more things, and I will. And C. Shepherd and I may form a plan to go back to Japan and do some more work, because C. Shepherd is doing the flagship is going down to the Antarctic to intervene. For the whales against the Japanese whaling. Japan is going down there to even try to take the humpback whale and the fin whale on top of the minke whale. And the first two, these two other species are quite endangered, so, you know, they have to be stopped. So Sea Shepherd's ship is going down there, and I was talking with them about having a parallel land campaign to complement that sea campaign, and I believe that would be very useful, and actually I believe it is necessary. So I may go back to Japan in about November.
I see. Now, Carl, you have a question.
Yes, Anthony, you know, when editorial in Edmonton newspaper it said, Paul Watson calls himself a traitor to the human race without shame and without regret. This marine activist long ago switched his allegiance from mankind to Mother Nature. Now, would you fall into the same category? Would you make an allegiance with Mother Nature?
Well,
a traitor to the human race?
Well, all activists, first and foremost, have to be independent thinkers. So you know, of course, I don't align myself to anybody's thinking. Sorry about this.
The mic just fell off. Maybe I'm talking too loud.
Okay, so, anyway, Paul Watson is known as a misanthrope, and I'm not quite that much myself. I have a higher opinion of my own species than Paul does, but I'm as biocentric as he is. In other words, we have to fit into a biocentric worldview as a part of it or a cog of it, instead of we being... be putting ourselves into the center of an anthropocentric universe. And Paul and I agree on that.
Now, the other question I have is also that one of the members of the Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection Society, she wrote a letter to Paul Martin, and I thought it was Anne Berthesel, and she said, Canada is presumed to be a haven and a place of reason and compassion. That's the image that they like to create. But they banned photographers from the ice floes, and that is, she says, that's not an aspiring way to go, together with the bludgeoning deaths of sentient beings. And this is being the first government to put compassion ahead of economic interests, which you also, of course, were talking about. And that the government is very sensitive to the image in the international world. And maybe you can just address that a bit.
Well, I really indeed do hope that the Canadian government is sensitive to world opinion, because this is what we're trying to generate, this world opinion against the Canadian seal hunt and the Canadian lack of compassion. And your opening statement that Canada is known as a compassionate nation, it is a veiled statement, I would think, because there were two major sectors of Canada. One is the public sector, the other one is the private sector. The government is what I'm talking about. The public sector, the government has absolutely no compassion as a motivation at all in its policy forming. However, Canada is also known as the cradle of environmentalism, and in fact it was the place of birth of Greenpeace, and of course Sea Shepherd is an offshoot of Greenpeace, and have since, I believe, in my opinion, eclipsed Greenpeace in its direction. And so the private sector actually is the Canadian private sector. I'm actually quite impressed by, and it is very, it indeed is quite compassionate, but the Canadian government is totally another matter altogether.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you. Now, do we have a little bit of time left right
yes,
now?
Yes,
we do. Okay. One thing that I heard Paul Watson the other night, and you're talking about the human relationship as being, well, it's part of the animal kingdom, so I don't think you have to be compassionate to other animals and not to human beings, but I was, as Paul said, that when he was born, which was about 50 years ago, there were 3 billion Canadian, 3 billion humans in the world, and now there are almost 7 billion. Well, it does seem as though maybe the humans are taking up too much of the resources of the planet.
Well, there's no doubt about that. Our population, if we don't control it actively, and that is, in a global collective plan basis, we are going to eat ourselves out of house and home, and eventually probably have to cannibalize ourselves. But we, and I can give you one little example. I gave a tiger conservation slideshow in San Francisco, and there was a woman in the audience who was paying me very, very, very close attention. And I was quite pleased about that. And then during the question-answer period, she asked me, Mr. Maher, do you believe in human birth control? I said, absolutely, 150%. She says, in that case, you're not going to get a single cent out of me. So there was a lot of sort of retarding forces going on in the world. The old-time organized religions, particularly Catholicism, from where I hailed, actually, is a retarding force, and I think that they better get civilized, otherwise they're going to doom our own world. But, I would like to say this, that human beings are very evil if they want to be evil. In fact, if we are bad, we're extremely, extremely bad, but if we're good, I think we're very, very good. The six people in this room, I believe, are... represent very, very good living things. And I think that, since we're humans, we are a good species if we want to be.
Yes, this is from Jenna Hunt. Anthony, were you familiar with how they stopped the seal hunt before? I know it was stopped before, and do you know what the techniques were used to motivate the Canadian government?
The techniques was actually Sea Shepherd is an organization that uses celebrity very effectively, and it was Brigitte Bardot at that point who went on the ice and brought the cruelty and the killing of the baby seals to world attention. And because she's such a widely regarded voice, Europe very shortly after that had a ban of Canadian seal products, and because of drying up of that market, the seal hunt was put on hold for a few years.
That's a great technique. I mean, to me, I think if people like Paris Hilton, she's such a celebrity, and well, Gwyneth Paltrow could be effective. I think Paris is not that advanced, but Gwyneth Paltrow.
Well, Paris actually has made some public statements on behalf of animals too. I've heard her say that. One thing that's effectively done once doesn't mean that it can be done with the same success, because media wants something new, and media wants things not to be repeated. So we've got to find something new. And also, Brigitte Bardot had something to her favor, which is the cuddly white newborn pups. And Canada says that they're no longer hunting these white coats, so that baby image is gone for us to use.
We have to take a break now. We're listening to Animal Voices on 102.7 FM in Vancouver. We're going to take a little music break, and then we'll be back with an interview with PETA, and after that, back to Anthony Maher.
Is this mic working?
Gordon Liddy. Recently, my friends at PETA revealed terrible cruelty to monkeys during an undercover investigation at a drug testing laboratory owned by Covance. PETA's investigator videotaped workers striking, choking, taunting, and tormenting terrified monkeys. She documented small monkeys choking, gagging, and bleeding from their noses after having large tubes forced up their nostrils and down into their stomachs. Monkeys with broken arms and other severe injuries were denied proper veterinary treatment, and many animals in desperate need of euthanasia were kept alive and in agony just to please drug companies. Please help us put an end to this nightmare that these monkeys endure in this laboratory every day. These intelligent and social animals cannot speak for themselves, so we must be their voices. To learn more about Covance and how you can help the animals in its laboratories, please visit www.covancecruelty.com.
Yes, and this is 102.7 FM in Vancouver, Animal Voices Radio. And the voice you heard was from the PETA website. It was by G. Gordon Liddy. And I have on the line Dr. Alka Chandra. Hello, Dr. Chandra.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Who is Gordon Liddy?
Gordon Liddy actually is infamous for his role in the Watergate scandal, but he, of course, has done his time for that. And since has shown himself to be a very compassionate person where animals are concerned. He's a great friend of PETA and is particularly concerned about animals and experimentation. So he recorded this very nice PSA for us.
Well, it's a very powerful voice for you.
Yes, I agree.
Now, who is Covance and how did PETA come to be involved with them, please?
Well, John, Covance is one of the world's largest drug testing companies. They test pharmaceuticals for the big pharmaceutical companies. And they use animals extensively in their testing procedures. They're located in over 18 countries, although they're headquartered here in the United States. They turn an annual revenue of over $1 billion every year. So they're very, very big. They are the world's largest producer of dogs. They breed dogs for use in experimentation, and they are the world's largest breeder of dogs for that sad fate in experimentation laboratories. And they're also the U.S.'s largest importer of wild-caught monkeys for use in experimentation. So, you know, that they have a lot of ethical problems in a lot of different ways.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did you put your undercover agent into these labs?
Well, all of our undercover agents, what they do is they take jobs. They actually get employment with these places of abuse. So at Covance, our investigator, she's gone public now, and her name is Lisa Layton. She took a job as a primate technician.
So she has qualifications of some sort and like that?
Yeah, she has a master's in, I believe, animal behavioral work. So, you know, she has experience with animals. She's worked in, you know, other animal facilities and has handled animals. And so she was well qualified for the job. She didn't say that she was with PETA, obviously, but she did give them her other qualifications, and they hired her as a primate technician. And she was employed in that lab. It was in Vienna, Virginia, which is just outside of Washington, D.C. She was employed in that lab for over 11 months, and during that time she took undercover video footage. She was fitted with a video camera and took notes of what was going on, and that became the basis of our very large complaint that was filed with the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture, citing violations of the Animal Welfare Act at Covance.
So you have a lawsuit against the United States government?
Well, no, it's a complaint. It's it's a document that's 272 pages long, and in the document we cite all of the places where Covance failed to abide by the Animal Welfare Act, which is the single piece of federal legislation here in the United States that is supposed to protect animals in laboratories. And we found hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of violations of the Animal Welfare Act. So what happens is that we sent, we compiled this document, this very large document, and sent it to the United States Department of Agriculture along with all of the video and audio documentation to back it up. And we've asked the USDA to investigate Covance and basically shut down the laboratories, and currently they're doing the investigation.
And Covance was also busted in Europe by the British Union for the abolition of vivisection?
That's right, John. This is actually our investigation, which just took place this past year, was actually the third investigation that's been done into a Covance facility. Ours, of course, was here in the United States, but as you point out, BUAV, the British Union for the Abolition of Vivisection, did an investigation at the Covance facility in Münster, Germany. And there was previously, about 10 years ago, another investigation that was done at the Harrogate facility in the UK by yet another animal organization. And, you know, across the board, in these three different countries, three different facilities, all run by Covance, we're seeing the same stuff, you know, the same horrible abuse of the animals. These monkeys are being taunted by the people that work with them, you know, thrown against the cages, being very violently handled, being slapped, and all of this sort of thing.
And made extremely sick.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's just part of the protocol. What happens is because they're dosing these animals, in other words, giving these animals the test substance. You know, these are going to be various chemical compounds. So they do what's called gavaging the animals. So tubes are forced up the nose, nostrils.
That's extremely painful, isn't it?
It is extremely painful. And, you know, one of the things that we saw in the Vienna, Virginia laboratory is that the Covance facility was using monkeys who were 1 to 2 years old. These are basically juvenile monkeys. They're very small, and their nostrils are also very small. They were using these animals because they couldn't find other animals. So they were using very inappropriate animals, basically babies. And the tubes, they didn't even have the decency to purchase tubes that would be the right size. So when they were forcing these tubes up the nostrils, they would always hit the sinus cavities. And so there would be, you know, bleeding from the nose, in addition to the fact that they were poisoning these animals slowly. So it's just, you know, just horrendous every way, which way you cut it. And our investigator would, you know, go to her supervisor and say, please, you know, get the right size of tube. And he would be very cavalier about it. Once he even made a joke that he really didn't care that the animals were bleeding from their noses, that as far as he was concerned, she could attach razor blades to the end of the gavage tubes. You know, so what you're looking at is a culture in this corporation where even the supervisors don't care about the animals, and they make that clear to, you know, their associates, to the people who work for them. And so there is, you know, horrendous abuse that you see as a result.
Well, you've got posted on your website several pages, quite striking pages. Here's one, what the investigator heard, and I guess you tape recorded some of these conversations too. God damn, I'm going to knock you out, you little bitch, you little hateful ass, you. That's what a senior Covance technician talking to a monkey who he's restraining. He says again, yeah, I'm coming for you again today. Yeah, you again today. I'm going to kick your ass again too. That's a female Covance technician. Now, these don't sound like scientists to whom we should entrust our health.
Absolutely. I think you've hit the nail on the head with this, with, you know, what you're saying right now, John. It's just unbelievable. You know, these monkeys, they're juvenile monkeys. They're small creatures. They're totally at the mercy of these people in the labs. And, you know, I mean, the monkeys, it's just really, you know, if you watch the video, it's so moving because you'll see that some of these technicians are pulling monkeys out of their cages and, you know, they're being very violent with them, slapping them, speaking harshly to them, using, you know, abusive language with them, you know, which is clearly violent, and the monkeys understand that. And then you'll see little monkeys in the cages next door, and they're reaching out their tiny little arms and pulling at the shirts of the technicians to get them to stop the abuse. I mean, you can't even, you know, look at that without being very moved by what's going on. I mean, they know what's going on. They know it's bad. They're trying to stop the violence for their cage mates. And, I mean, these people just, it's like they were declaring a war against the animals. It was a one-sided war against these poor monkeys.
Yeah, well, these are subhuman people, in my opinion. Now, one of them says, oh, your belly looks bad. All I know is if I had that rash on my belly by an incision site, I'd be at the hospital on some serious antibiotics.
Yeah.
But I don't give a damn about you, monkey.
Yeah, it's very sad. And, I mean, there again, there's another really important point. Now, the Animal Welfare Act here in the United States, and I know there are similar issues in Canada, when you have, a scientist or whomever performing experiments in a laboratory, in a lot of senses, they're exempt from the regular anti-cruelty laws that we see. If you punch a dog, for example, if you're caught, you will be prosecuted, hopefully. If there's a compassionate judge, the laws exist to protect the dog. But such laws don't exist to protect monkeys in labs or other animals, dogs, cats, and mice, rats, etc. The laws are always on the side of the scientists. They're always on the side of the vivisectors. What they do is exempt.
Because they're helping humanity, of course, because they're helping humanity.
Yep, that's the PR line, all right.
Yeah, now, doesn't it seem to anyone obvious that when you have a monster in a cage, such as a monkey who is terrified out of its wits, I mean, all its systems are at a point where everything is panicking, and the systems are overloaded. How can you really conduct a scientific test that has any kind of scientific precision or value?
You're absolutely right. You know, the scientists even have a term for that. These animals, when they're caged, and primates, of course, being extremely intelligent, social beings, they're caged, they're kept alone. For example, in covants, they were, single caged. They didn't have buddies with them, so they're totally alone. They're in these cages that don't replicate in any way how they would be living in the wild. They eat a monotonous diet. They don't exercise at all. They're just there in that little cage where they can take one step in each direction, but that's all they can do.
And they have no veterinary care, so
there's no veterinary care.
Like a hospital where you're treating the sick. You're actually making the monkey sick and then not actually treating him at all, but putting them through this torture. I mean,
exactly,
the whole thing makes
torture.
No sense.
It doesn't make any sense. And just to continue on the point that you were making from before, you've got these monkeys in the cage. I mean, everything changes. Their hormones elevate, their respiration changes, their heart rate increases. And so their entire metabolic rates are totally different than what they would be normally if they weren't in that cage, which really means that monkeys in cages are not good models. They're not good models for regular monkeys. So how do they become good models for human beings? And scientists know this. They see that these monkeys start going crazy, and it's true for all animals in labs, actually. They start going crazy. They're called stereotypies. They'll perform the same actions over and over again, like they'll spin in their cages or they'll rock back and forth. They'll do somersaults endlessly for half an hour at a time. Basically, they've gone insane, and that also exacerbates the extent to which they're not going to be good models for whatever it is that the scientists are trying to get out of them. And the scientists know that the fear and stress that the monkeys feel affects the data that's gathered from the animals, but they just have decided to ignore it. They just say, yeah, it's true, it changes the results, it mars the results, but we can't do anything about it, which is just... it's not where we should be putting our tax dollars. It's not how we should be looking into health issues. It's just bad science, period.
Yes, I'm Jenna Hunt, and I would just like to ask you a question. On your website, too, are you familiar with the lawsuit against Merck for animal testing, and do you think that's going to help advance your cause?
Oh, that's a really good question. Yeah, I think the public is becoming more and more in tune with the fact that the pharmaceutical companies are giving short shrift to human health concerns. When they put all these pharmaceuticals out there, they know there's a problem with how the pharmaceuticals are being tested. And naturally, since animal testing is part of the whole testing process, animal experimentation will also be scrutinized in this. I just want to throw out that last year, in July of 2004, the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, released its statistic indicating that of all of the drugs that are found to be safe and effective in animals, 92% fail when they're put into humans. So animal testing for drug safety and effectiveness, is a 92% failure. It has a 92% failure rate when the drugs go into humans. I mean, which is just outrageous.
And the opposite side of the coin is that we may be missing cures for human beings on the basis of rejecting them on animals which have different physio systems, right?
That's absolutely right, John. And, you know, anybody who does a study of the history of animal use in testing drugs perhaps will remember the great example of penicillin. Penicillin was found to be unsafe in guinea pigs. It's actually toxic to guinea pigs. It kills them. And one of the people who found, who discovered penicillin, Alexander Fleming, he said that fortunately there was a shortage of guinea pigs on the world market when he discovered penicillin, and so they couldn't ever put the drug in penicillin, and that's why it finally made its way to people. He said, if there hadn't been such a shortage of guinea pigs at that time, well, we probably would have never allowed penicillin to be used in human beings, and the whole world of antibiotics would never have been discovered as a medical miracle for humans.
Right. So it's just by chance. And let's go on a little bit because we are just about out of time. What happened at Louisiana State University?
I think everybody now, of course, is aware of the terrible tragedy going on in the Gulf Coast with human beings and Hurricane Katrina. The animal devastation has just been horrible, and we just got word 2 days ago that every single one of the 8,000 animals that were kept in labs at Louisiana State University have died. Some of them have drowned, others have suffocated, others have starved to death, and some of them were actually fortunate enough, if you can say that, to be euthanized. But this is just abysmal. The animal facilities, everybody knew the hurricane was coming. You know, these animals were absolutely at the mercy of the researchers, and the researchers failed them hugely. They should have all been euthanized, or they should have, the scientists should have found other places to keep these animals. But a death toll of 8,000, 100% of the animals is just abysmal. You know, another thing about that is that Louisiana State University has one of the nation's hot labs, which is to say that's where some of the most dangerous pathogens, you know, bacteria and viruses and other germs, are examined. And so you're talking about a public health risk of just massive proportions. There are other labs down there as well, like the Tulane Primate Research Center, where they have, I believe, over 5,000 primates. Now, fortunately, there weren't any deaths, so the vivisectors can have at those primates and continue doing their horrific work. But there also, they do infectious disease studies. So to have all of these animals carrying infectious diseases that are put at risk in an area which is a high-risk area, weather-wise, is just folly. So we're calling on the government here in the United States, it's the Health and Human Resources, Health and Human Services people who would give federal monies for rebuilding. So we're asking them not to give LSU, Louisiana State University, any money to rebuild the animal facilities.
Thank you very much, Dr. Chandra. I appreciate you coming online with us today.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for all the great work you do, and thanks to your listeners for being concerned about these important issues.
And bravo to you.
Take care.
Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
That was Dr. Alka Chandra. Now we're going to get back to a little more conversation with Anthony Marr. Yeah,
thank you, John. We have just a very few minutes, but Anthony, I would like to ask you for your comment on the mandate of the Fisheries, Canadian Fisheries and Oceans Department to protect marine wildlife. Could you comment on the work they do there?
Well, let me just give you one very simple illustration, and that is...
There, got it. A little bit of trouble with our mics.
Sorry. Let me just give you one example, and that should answer your question. There is something called the Seal Protection Act, and which is an absolute joke. It is the protection of sealers and the protection of sealing and the protection of seal killing. And, for example, when the activists go onto the ice to try to intervene with the killing of the seals, it is actually in direct contravention of the Seal Protection Act. And that is about as comical as things could get. Basically, the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, Paul Watson calls them the Department of Fishery Business, is, in our opinion, incompetent and insincere. Incompetent in that they have biologists to tell them that it is not a simple equation between seals and cod, more seals, more cod. There is another 20 or 30 species of fish that feed on cod that the seals feed on, that, and the seals actually control their population so that they don't overfeed on the cod. And the DFO is entirely a sort of fisheries corporation, basically. And, you know, one of their starting points is wrong, is fisheries. Seals are not fish. Seals are mammals.
And they're really using the seals as scapegoats, aren't they, for the diminishing cod, which is probably the responsibility of the DFO.
Well, that's exactly right. But they would never admit to it. But I can tell you that on the West Coast, there used to be a seal hunt as well between 1940 and 1970. It was banned in 1970. And during the seal hunt, and the seal population was reduced by about 90% by the late 1960s before they banned the hunt, according to the DFO's equation, the salmon population should be sky high because the seal population was almost wiped out. But it wasn't the case. And also by the 1980s and 90s, after the seal population has been reestablished, the salmon population should have died, should have taken a nosedive. But just the opposite is true. In the 1950s and 60s, the salmon population went down together with the seals, and the salmon population reestablished itself along with the seals in the 1980s and 90s. And this of course, we also have to take into consideration the volume of commercial and native fisheries as well into this equation. But we also have to include those 20 or 30 other species of fish that feed on salmon over here into the equation. And the DFO is not doing that. They're just saying, you know, if we kill off all the seals, the cod will come back, which is absolutely not going to happen.
Now, one last question, Anthony, and that is, where do you get your inspiration after all these years of plugging along, working to educate the public and get change for improvement with the animals and so on? And there have been some gains, granted, but where does your inspiration come from?
Well, basically from two things. Number one is directly from the animals. The animals capture my heart actively by their beauty and by their... but the necessity of existence in this world. And secondly, it is also because of people like yourself who sort of give me advice and let me speak out to the general public and so on. That, without you, I can't do a thing.
That's wonderful to hear, Anthony, and thank you so much for coming down to Animal Voices today. We really appreciate having you.
Thank you much.
Give us your website, Anthony.
It's hope-care.org, hope-care.org.
No longer Hope Geo?
No longer. Okay. Somebody's told that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
All right, well, I think that wraps it up. That's the end of our program. We hope you enjoyed this edition of Animal Voices on Co-op Radio, 102.7 FM, and you'll tune in again next week. This program is repeated every Monday at 4 o'clock. Thanks to our interesting guests, Anthony Marr and Dr. Chandra, and... this wonderful studio is always helping us along. So our website is animalvoices.org. Thanks for listening. See you next week.